Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The COVID surge continues to spike as states set new measures to tamp the spread of the virus. Then, accepting the results, more Republicans speak up to say Joe Biden won as President Trump continues to make false assertions about the election outcome. Plus, the disinformation war. Social media companies again grapple with how to contain lies at a critical time. And global reaction. Foreign governments respond to Joe Biden's victory over President Trump, offering a glimpse of the United States' future role in the world. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. There are two major stories tonight, the post-election transition, as President Trump refuses to concede or even allow for the traditional preparations that would normally have begun, and the surging burden of COVID cases in most areas of the country. The U.S. hit a new daily record of COVID-19 infections with more than 144,000 reported yesterday. Hospitalizations topped 65,000 for the first time. 22 states are reporting more hospitalizations than at any time since the pandemic began. Deaths are up by 22% from a week ago. Let's look at how this is hitting a number of states, especially hard, no matter which region. In El Paso, Texas, makeshift clinics outside hospitals are opening up. Mobile morgues are moving in, and a lockdown of non-essential businesses has been extended. Testing lines are growing in Wisconsin. Cases there have jumped from 700 a day to more than 6,000 in 2 months. To deal with its surge, Chicago's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, issued a 10-person limit on social gatherings and a stay-at-home advisory for non-essential needs starting next week. And in South Dakota, the highest hospitalization rate in the country, one out of every 1,600 residents is hospitalized with COVID. We asked a small group of Americans how these surges are affecting their lives.
My name is Dave Caton. I am a registered nurse at the Medical Intensive Care Unit and the COVID Intensive Care Unit at United Hospital in downtown St. Paul.
My name is Valerie Skirlant. I'm from Des Moines, Iowa, West Des Moines to be exact, and I'm a stay-at-home mom.
My name is Jared Berger. I work in the culinary department at a senior living community, and I am in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
My name is Jennifer Carey, and I am a substitute teacher. I live in Mandan, North Dakota.
My name is Caroline Long, and I am a special education teacher with Minneapolis Public Schools.
My name is Marie Cheslick. I'm a registered nurse in Chicago, Illinois.
I feel like I'm drowning. It's gotten to the point where in the last month, for sure, we've been completely full in the hospital. Every single COVID designated room has been full. And even last week, we had every room in the intensive care unit was full, and we would just get patients rolling onto the unit with no open room to go to.
I got sick on October 13th, and within a week, I found out that my husband, daughter, his best friend, and about 10 other people all became positive within a week's worth of time.
Every potential exposure that I have is a potential exposure to every single one of the 140 residents that I have to help make food for. And at the end of the day, the way I think about it is, would I be able to sleep at night or live with myself knowing that I could have potentially given this to somebody who couldn't fight it off?
I find myself running, and not finding times for breaks. And again, sort of normal on a perspective of being a nurse, but the way that it's happening with COVID right now is that it's nonstop.
There have been all these reports that, you know, it has a negative impact on communities of color, and having pre-existing health conditions myself and then being a woman of color, then I really worry about that.
In a family-oriented state like Iowa, it's very hard. It's very stressful, and it makes you feel like there will be some days where I feel like I'm the only one on board, you know, like, or maybe me and just a few hundred people that live here are taking it seriously.
It's only seeming like it's getting worse. And I'm afraid for the future. The burnout is from knowing that it's not getting better.
You would generally only see maybe 10% of people wearing masks. They do not social distance. In fact, if you do wear a mask, you're often looked at like, you know, oh, it's that crazy person who doesn't know how to live life.
It's unfortunate that this pandemic has been made such a political argument. And I don't think that needed to happen because it's really about the safety of lives, the safety of people.
I can be there for my patients, but more and more, it's less of bedside, being there emotionally and physically for that person. It's being there on a very strict medical level.
I'll have a few days at a time where I just don't even leave the house. All I do is literally drop my son off at school and then pick him up because I just want one less body out in the world that can be potentially getting this or spreading this.
I have held the hands of patients as they are dying. And I've had to tell family members that they can't come see their family members because they could potentially get the virus or spread the virus. And it's awful.
Two states, California and Texas, have now reported more than 1 million cases since this all began. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health said today he was hopeful the vaccines will make a real difference in slowing the pandemic, but he warned the virus could remain a chronic problem and said Americans need to double down on public health measures. We're going to look at that bigger picture now with Dr. Nicholas Christakis. He's a physician and a sociologist at Yale University. And he's the author of the new book, Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. Dr. Christakis, thank you very much for joining us. It is a powerful book. And with the fact the pandemic is doing so poorly right now, we are seeing it spread across the country again. I want to come to a point you make in the book, and that is you think a lot of decisions were made in the wrong direction early on. Not enough personal protective equipment, not enough done with regard to testing, not consistent guidance around masks. Paint that picture for us, if you would.
Well, the thing that we're experiencing right now is a once-in-a-century event. And early on, back in December and January even, experts had a very high expectation that this was likely to happen. And what we should have done, in my view, as soon as China locked down and put nearly a billion people under home confinement beginning January the 24th, we should have perked up our ears and said, oh my goodness, what's happening in China? We should prepare. And we should have done just the things that you mentioned, prepared our testing capacity, our masks, the public should have been steeled with resolve for what was ahead of us, and so on. And unfortunately, we didn't really make adequate preparations until we were really hit hard in March.
You also write, Dr. Christakis, about the politics of this, frankly, misinformation that went around public, just frankly, conspiracy theories that were allowed out there without being corrected, bad guidance. How much did that contribute to the slowness of the response in the United States?
Well, one of the things that's important to realize, unfortunately, is that for thousands of years, as the germ has spread through social networks from person to person, lies and denial have followed right behind. You might even say that lies and denial are part of what makes an epidemic. And you can understand it from a human point of view. People don't want to believe that this bad thing is happening. People wish to have superstitions about what might cause it or what might cure it. These are very normal human responses that human beings have been manifesting for hundreds or thousands of years. But it's the role of leadership, in my opinion, our leaders whom we elect, to help us not be that way, to help us actually see the world for how it is, and not kind of in a fantasy way, pretending that nothing is happening, when in fact our world has changed.
When we just learned in the last few days that the vaccine may be available in coming weeks or by the end of the year, early next year. But we're also hearing this warning from Dr. Fauci and others that it may be with us for a while. What do you think the real timeline is in terms of when life returns to a semblance of normal?
I think even if the vaccine or several vaccines are invented in the next few months, which is likely, we still have challenges in manufacturing, distributing, and persuading the public to accept the vaccine. And those challenges will take about a year. And meanwhile, the virus is still spreading, and it will continue to spread until we reach a threshold of about 40 to 50% of Americans who are infected. Right now, we're only at about 10%. That threshold is known as the herd immunity threshold. So that'll take us into 2022. So from my perspective, the first period during which we're confronting the biological and epidemiological impact of the virus, and we're living in a changed world, wearing masks, physical distancing, school closures, and so on, will last until sometime in 2022. And then we're going to begin a second period when we are recovering from the psychological, social, and economic shock of the virus. And this has been seen for thousands of years with other epidemics. And that'll take a couple of years for us to rebuild our economy and recover. And so sometime in 2024, I think, life will slowly begin to return to normal with some persistent changes.
So you see the behaviors that we've adopted today, whether it's mask wearing, social distancing, not shaking hands, that's going on for the foreseeable future. But do you think we will go back to what life was like before 2020 ever?
Yes, although there'll be some persistent changes. For example, in the 1918 pandemic, to pick a trivial example, the restaurants used to have spittoons, and spittoons were seen as unsanitary during a time of a respiratory pandemic. And so afterwards, spittoons disappeared and they never returned. So there are things like that on a bigger scale too, I think. For example, business travel, I think, will change. Teaching and working from home will change. I think there may even be some changes in the women's labor market participation. We are not the first generation of people to confront a serious epidemic. This has been a part of the human experience, and we will see the other side of it.
You write about, yes, we will see the other side, but you also write about the profound loss that we all have experienced. Dr. Nicholas Christakis, thank you so much. Again, the book is Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Now we turn to our other top story tonight, the presidential transition. President-elect Joe Biden is forging ahead, despite President Trump's refusal to concede. Last night, he tapped a longtime aide to be his chief of staff. There's also a growing chorus of Republicans who say the president-elect should be able to receive a daily national security briefing as soon as possible. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign's legal challenges to the vote count go on, despite many rejections. To discuss all this, I'm joined by our Yamiche Alcindor and Lisa Desjardins. Hello to both of you. So, Lisa, following the Biden folks, we know that he so far, as we reported, he's been denied access to these, what he normally would get, which is a daily intelligence briefing. But as we say, there are some Republicans who are beginning to speak up for him. Tell us about that.
This is fascinating. Today, we saw more Republicans come out not for and saying that the election is over, but saying that it is time for President-elect Biden to get classified briefings. That includes some top Republicans and some Trump allies like Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. They seem to be threading a needle here, Judy, not yet ready to openly defy the president, President Trump, but saying that some steps need to be taken to allow President-elect Biden to understand critical classified information. Here's one of those Republican senators, Mike Rounds of South Dakota.
Look, one of these two men will be the president of the United States after the election results have come in. And I think at this point, just as a matter of protecting our nation's interests, I do think that both the president and his competition here, of Vice President Biden, should have access to those classified reports.
you hear that threading of the needle there where Republicans are saying if Joe Biden becomes president, he should have this information, still not saying they're ready to declare him, all of them, president-elect. Judy, this was sort of tipped off by Oklahoma Senator James Lankford, who is pressing the General Services Administration, an agency with a very broad name, to make this call, to kind of push forward on with transition in some ways. The GSA, which is run by a Trump appointee, has refused to do that so far. Adding to this pressure, Judy, there was a letter today from 150 national security officials, former officials, generals, admirals, folks who worked in many different counterterrorism agencies, saying President-elect Biden needs these classified briefings. If he doesn't get them, there could be, in their words, immense consequences for national security.
And Yamiche, what about at the White House? Any movement today in terms of how they are handling, how they see this transition, and any movement in terms of the president accepting the election result?
There isn't much movement. The president remains angry, isolated, and unwilling to acknowledge that Joe Biden is, in fact, the president-elect. And it was 1 week ago today that the president took to the White House podium to say that he had won the election and was doing what no president before him had done, which was challenge the integrity of the election. And the president has continued to do that over and over again in tweets and messages. But one thing that we have to note, this is the longest period of time the president has not spoken publicly in his entire presidency. The president is someone who likes to speak in front of camera, likes to engage with reporters. We just have not heard him. That goes to the isolation. I should tell you that I've been talking to people in this White House, and they feel anxious and fearful. They are very anxious that the president is having to continue to process this and that the world really is waiting for President Trump to get on board with the fact that he has lost this election. And there are young White House staffers, young Republicans who have been warned that if they start looking for new jobs, if they start trying to move on, that they will be fired immediately. But campaign aides have told me that people are already starting to roll off. So coming this weekend, you're going to start seeing the campaign staff get smaller and smaller. So even though President Trump doesn't want to admit it, this is a White House that is unwinding, is backing away from President Trump.
And Yamiche, staying with you, you've been taking a really close look at some of the claims the president, the people around him are making, both in their public statements and in these legal suits, legal actions. What are you finding?
That's right. The president and his allies continue to make false claims in most cases that there is mass fraud that hurt President Trump in this election. And just this hour, the Trump campaign was holding a briefing for reporters, and they said that it's going to take time, that this is not something of a matter of instant gratification, and then they're not going to bite all of the apple at once. As a result, they've been really trying to defend their lawsuits. But I want to walk you through some of the claims that they're making that critics say are fiction and frivolous. One is in Nevada. They're saying there that there are ballots that have military addresses used by active military officials that should be invalidated. There are, of course, people that say that those addresses are, of course, completely valid. In Michigan, we saw a Republican woman, say that she saw poll workers wearing Black Lives Matter gear and a man was following her that looked big. That's her claim there. Then we see in Arizona, there was this argument that Sharpies, if you used a marker on a ballot, that it wasn't going to be counted. All of those things have either been disclaimed or are being fought through in court. But what we're seeing is judges throw these cases out one after the other because of some of the information that I just said. These are not people who have real information about voter claim. Instead, these are anecdotal information that they say could be problematic.
And finally, Lisa, quickly back to you. We know that President-elect Biden is starting to make some announcements about positions he wants to fill. His chief of staff, he says, will be Ron Klain. What do we know about him and how he'll operate?
Ron Klain has been with President-elect Biden since he was a whiz kid at 28 on the Judiciary Committee. This selection, Judy, indicates that President-elect Biden is going to rely on people who know him and people who are expert and strong in their fields. Ron Klain, a long resume, including his work fighting the Ebola pandemic when Biden was in the White House before.
All right, we will leave it there. Lisa Desjardins, Yamiche Alcindor, thank you both. While President-elect Biden continues to push forward with transition planning, there are several states yet to be called. In Georgia, Biden leads President Trump by more than 14,000 votes, and the state will conduct a hand recount of nearly 5 million ballots. The state's Republican congressional delegation has asked for an investigation into any claims of voter fraud. But the Secretary of State, also a Republican, says that no such claims have been substantiated. Congressman Buddy Carter is a Republican from Georgia, and he joins me now. Congressman, thank you very much for talking with us. First of all, do you expect this count to go ahead tomorrow? And do you expect to, what do you expect it to show?
Well, I do expect for it to go forward, and it should go forward. And let me clarify that the congressional delegation, the House delegation, what we asked for was for the Secretary of State to grant the wishes of the Donald J. Trump campaign and the Georgia Republican Party. And the Secretary of State has done that. He has acknowledged that he's going to do a hand recount. We appreciate that. We applaud those efforts. And we think it will lead to a transparent and honest result. So it's a good thing that we're doing this.
Do you expect it to overturn the results? And if it doesn't, are you prepared to accept the results?
Well, certainly we're prepared to accept the results, and certainly that's a lot of votes to overturn. We understand that. But the important thing to remember here is whether you are a Democrat or a Republican or independent, you want honest, transparent elections. You want to make sure every vote is counted. You want to make sure that no illegal vote is counted. You want to make sure that no vote is miscounted. We need to have confidence in our election system. And that's what this is about.
As you know, though, with recounts that have been done in the past, nothing like that number of votes have been changed. It's been in the hundreds. But what I want to ask you, Congressman, is you were reelected in your district, Georgia's first district, Savannah, and along the Atlantic coast. If there were problems statewide, do you believe there were problems in your district with your count?
Well, possibly there could have been. And certainly we have gotten calls in our office from constituents who are concerned that there were some discrepancies. And we have done what we are supposed to do, and that is we have directed them to the proper place to file their concern and to enter their concerns. And we'll continue to do that. But it is the responsibility of the Secretary of State to research these kind of concerns. And that's what all we're doing is asking the Secretary of State to do his job.
Are you personally aware of instances where either fraud was committed or ballots were cast illegally? Do you personally know of instances that the voters should be worried about?
We have had calls into our office expressing those concerns. Again, it's not our responsibility to research those concerns. It's our responsibility to direct the people where they are to go to file those concerns. And that's what we've been doing in our office. But yes, there have been, I wouldn't necessarily think, I don't know that it was fraud. I hope it wasn't. But I do know that they have expressed some legitimate concerns.
But I guess what I'm asking is there enough malfeasance that's gone on, do you think? Because that's what President Trump is saying every day, that the election was stolen from him. And he's pointed specifically to the state of Georgia. So I'm trying to understand, what is it that you've seen? I mean, you know the state. You've been serving in Congress. This will be your fourth term. What do you see that would back that up?
Well, again, I think that the focus here has to be on the Secretary of State, making sure that all of us have confidence that this was done correctly and that every legal vote was counted. Now, if it turns out that the Secretary of State comes back and reports there was no fraud, there was no widespread problems, then certainly we will probably be forced to accept that. But it's important, again, for everyone, whether you're Democrat, Republican, independent, that you have confidence in the system, that we have a transparent and honest system, and that if there were problems during this election, we get them corrected so that we don't have those problems reoccur. But I will tell you that there's still ways to go. This president has every right to fight, and he is doing just that. He has every right to demand a fair and a transparent and honest return on the elections, and that's what he's asking to have done right now.
And you're not concerned that the voters from this experience will come away with less confidence in our democratic system?
Well, I think with the recalls, I think with correcting whatever kind of problems we may have experienced, keep in mind for a lot of these states, this was the first time they've done a number of these types of things. Here in the state of Georgia, we've never had this many absentee ballots before. In fact, we had 10 times as many as we normally have. So obviously that increases the potential for errors. And that's why we have to make sure that we've got it right. That's all we're asking here, is just to make sure that it is accurate, that every legal vote was counted, and that no illegal votes were counted.
Congressman Buddy Carter of Georgia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, despite a dramatic surge in COVID-19 infections, the U.S. labor market is showing some signs of healing. 709,000 more Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week. That is the lowest level since March and the fourth straight drop. Still, numbers remain, at historic highs. Overall, 6.8 million people continue to receive jobless aid. The U.S. Treasury Department today reported that the federal government ran up a record $284 billion budget deficit just for the month of October. That shortfall was nearly double what it was in October of last year. Meanwhile, on Wall Street, stocks plummeted amid the record-shattering surge in COVID-19 infections. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 317 points to close at 29,080. The Nasdaq fell 77 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 35. In Egypt, a helicopter carrying multinational force and observers, peacekeepers, crashed today, killing at least 8 people, including 6 American service members. It went down off the Sinai Peninsula. Authorities said it appeared to be an accident. The multinational force monitors a 40-year peace agreement between Israel and Egypt. The United Nations Migration Agency says that at least 74 migrants drowned after a Europe-bound ship broke down and capsized off the coast of Libya. It is the latest tragedy in a series of at least 8 shipwrecks in the central Mediterranean since October. So far this year, at least 900 people have drowned in the Mediterranean trying to reach Europe. Pro-democracy legislators in Hong Kong officially handed in their resignation letters today. It was a mass protest after Beijing kicked out 4 of their colleagues this week. The 15 opposition lawmakers refused to attend this morning's legislative session, leaving their seats empty. They insist that Hong Kongers must continue to stand for autonomy from Beijing.
So what's left for Hong Kong's democracy fight? That's the most valid question. But it doesn't mean that, the end of it and we all go home and forget about a democracy or human rights or any core values. We do not underestimate Hong Kong people, especially our young.
The mass resignations come as Beijing continues its crackdown on the semi-autonomous region. The Legislative Council is now left with 43 lawmakers, 41 of whom are considered pro-Beijing. In the Philippines, the aftermath of a destructive typhoon has left the country reeling. At least 13 people died and 15 others are still missing. Floodwaters completely submerged some northeastern towns, forcing people to climb on their rooftops. Rescue efforts are underway as many residents remain trapped. Some 200,000 people were forced to evacuate. Back in this country, heavy rains pummel Florida's western coast today after Tropical Storm Eta crashed ashore for the second time. It happened before dawn, just north of the Tampa Bay area, packing maximum sustained winds of 50 miles an hour. Now out to sea, Eta is forecast to lose strength as it moves northeast over the Atlantic. And a federal appeals court in Boston has ruled that Harvard University's admissions policies do not discriminate against Asian Americans. An affirmative action group had argued that the school went too far in using race to consider students. But two judges today upheld a lower court decision that rejected those claims. Today's ruling paves the way for a possible review by the U.S. Supreme Court. Still to come on the News Hour, social media companies combat disinformation in the wake of the election. The world responds to Joe Biden's defeat of President Trump, and more.
This is the PBS News Hour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Well before the election and ever since, President Trump has repeatedly tweeted out misinformation and outright falsehoods about mail-in ballots, about voting, the counting process, and more. That's also been true for some of the president's supporters and some in conservative media. As William Brangham tells us, social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have been trying to limit the spread of disinformation, but it's more complicated than it appears.
That's right, Judy. The social media companies have tried to put warnings and labels on misleading information. In some cases, Twitter tried to make it harder for users to spread posts that were labeled with misinformation. Facebook took down a network of pages with false information about voter fraud that was tied to the hashtag #StopTheSteal. But despite all of these moves, false information still finds its way out on so many other networks and so many other platforms. Elizabeth Dwoskin is a reporter with The Washington Post who covers this space, and she joins me now. Elizabeth, great to have you back on the NewsHour. Just remind us what Facebook and Twitter and these social media companies have been doing thus far to try to stamp out misinformation.
Sure. Well, the companies are hell-bent on avoiding the repeat of 2016, the scenario where their platforms were abused by Russian operatives. So this year, they took unprecedented measures to change their platforms. Facebook disabled group recommendations. It banned political ads, which they've extended. Twitter, as you said, slapped these labels on content where they actually covered up content for the first time and said these claims are disputed. And they banned claims that would dispute election results. They banned any kind of intimations of violence at the polls. So all these were unprecedented measures for companies that had never actually banned misinformation of any kind prior to 2020.
I mean, I certainly understand the instinct, and many people do. Some, not just on the right, argue that this is just flat out suppression of free speech. That's a separate conversation for now. But despite these efforts, and there are still ways for tenacious actors to get around the flags and the labels and the blocks, right?
Absolutely. And one of the most interesting things that I saw observing what played out last week in the election and its aftermath was that these groups arose around the hashtag #StopTheSteal. And Facebook has this balancing act because on the one hand, they do want to allow people to protest and, you know, say that they don't believe in the election, that they want to be a platform for people to say those kinds of things. At the same time, a lot of what those groups are being mobilized on and fueled by is misleading information, and not just accidental misleading information, but active campaigns like those put out by Steve Bannon. Facebook removed a network tied to Steve Bannon last week, former Trump's chief strategist, where they're sowing active disinformation and doubt about the voting process. None of these misleading claims around Sharpies in Arizona, dead people voting in Pennsylvania, Biden purportedly claiming to support voter fraud, those claims have not borne out. And so this popular movement to contest the election has been fueled by misinformation. And while Facebook and Twitter want to stop the misinformation, they also do believe that people do have a right to some extent to organize in the way they want. And that's why you saw last week that they banned some groups, but hundreds of other groups proliferated.
within this ecosystem of misinformation, certainly we've seen on the networks, Fox News in particular, some of their primetime hosts have been a big vehicle for this as well. And I want to play this clip that aired on Fox News recently. This is Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, who are two of the primetime hosts. And they were talking about some of these labels that Twitter had been putting on tweets of the president's. And they were suggesting that people who are sick of this kind of intrusion, as they say, ought to go somewhere else. Let's listen to this.
Every time Trump tweets now, it says this claim about election fraud is disputed. But do you notice how anything the left says, is any of it ever blue flagged like that, like Twitter does?
Can we now move everybody from Twitter to Parler? Can we just make the shift together, like just say goodbye, Twitter?
For people who don't follow this that closely, what is Parler and why has it become such a sensation?
Parler is a quote-unquote pro-free speech social network. It's an alternative free social network that was founded about 2 years ago to tackle supposedly censorship, quote-unquote censorship, by the tech giants. And yeah, what you're seeing is these commentators on Fox saying that everyone should leave the major platforms, Facebook and Twitter, and go to this alternative service where they can say anything about Stop the Steal, voter fraud, et cetera. And, you know, you actually saw it had an effect. I think we wrote this week that Parler became the top download in the Apple App Store. It saw a this last weekend, it saw a huge surge in users. But you also have to remember that the people who are trying to create a sustained movement to oppose the results of the presidential election want it to be as broad as possible. And so they don't just want to sit in an echo chamber on Parler, which has still a fraction of Facebook's multi-billion users. And so they still want to be on the main platforms.
Elizabeth Dwoskin of The Washington Post, thanks for helping us wade through all of this.
Thanks for having me.
American presidential elections always draw great and intense interest globally, and this year's vote was no different. Joe Biden's win has been met with a variety of reactions, elation in some regions, wariness in others, and some silence so far from American adversaries. Here's Nick Schifrin.
In the part of the world perhaps most excited for President-elect Biden, the Irish celebrated their luck. After 4 years of America First, Western Europe expressed hope for change.
Joe Biden has decades of experience in domestic and foreign policy. He knows Germany and Europe well.
Many European leaders have worked with Biden and share his day one priorities, re-entering the Paris Climate Accord, extending the New START Treaty with Russia, and rejoining the World Health Organization. Among Biden's first phone calls were European allies, including French President Emmanuel Macron.
I wanted really to congratulate you and congratulate Kamala Harris for this election.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been a Trump ally, and Biden has rejected Brexit. Yesterday, Johnson expressed relief. Yes, Biden emphasized shared values in their call.
It was refreshing, I may say, to have that conversation. I look forward to many more.
Biden's second round of calls were with East Asian allies, including South Korean President Moon Jae-in and Japan's new prime minister, Yoshihide Suga.
He said that he looks forward to strengthening the U.S.-Japan alliance and working together on achieving peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific region.
That phrase, the Indo-Pacific, was coined by Japan but expanded by the Trump administration to counter China. The administration, with bipartisan support, increased operations in the Pacific and accelerated regional cooperation, including with Australia, whose Prime Minister Scott Morrison also talked with Biden.
We agreed that there was no more critical time for both this alliance between ourselves and the United States, but more broadly, the working together, especially of like-minded countries.
Less like-minded Middle East leaders, the Trump administration facilitated accords between Israel and three Sunni Arab countries.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
It pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal to press confrontation with Iran. On Saturday, after the U.S. media declared Biden president-elect, Saudi leaders tweeted congratulations to the new president of Tanzania. The kingdom waited until late Sunday to congratulate Biden. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed Trump's policies would continue.
I welcome the fact that my friend Joe Biden and with him Kamala Harris welcomed those agreements.
But Biden has vowed to restart negotiations to re-enter the Iran nuclear agreement and withdraw support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Meanwhile, those who haven't congratulated Biden, Latin American populist Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, as well as North Korea's Kim Jong-un, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Chinese President Xi Jinping. In China, a cautious response and low expectations, as special correspondent Patrick Falk reports.
Burnished autumn leaves are a sign of changing times in Beijing. But as the U.S. prepares for a new era of leadership under Joe Biden, people here are sure about one thing. There'll be no seasonal shift in relations between China and America. Beijing's yet to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory, but there has been a change in tone from Chinese media. The state-run Global Times offered this view on Wednesday, saying the president-elect would be more cooperative than Trump.
What we've been seeing here in the press over the last few days is a focus on a chaotic situation in the U.S. And I've got a copy of the Global Times here from a few days ago with one article titled, Analysts Predict Final Madness in U.S.-China Policy in Last Days of Trump Presidency.
Patrick Falk in Beijing. To talk about world reaction, I'm joined by three guests. Marwan Muasher was Jordan's foreign minister and then deputy prime minister from 2002 to 2005. He's now vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Natalie Tocci is the director of the Institute for International Affairs in Italy and a special advisor to European Union Foreign Affairs Minister Josep Borrell. And Minxin Pei is a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, where he focuses on China. Welcome to the NewsHour for all of you. Thank you very much. Natalie Tocci, let's begin in Europe, which is where Biden says is his priority. We just went through how Europeans are expressing some relief, some hope about the future. But does Europe also believe that there are changes to the transatlantic alliance that will outlast Trump?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there are sort of two main aspects where Europeans are not expecting dramatic changes. The first is, I think, in trade policy. I mean, I think a degree of protectionism is probably likely to outlive Trump. I think as Europeans, we would expect that things like steel and aluminium tariffs would be taken off, but we would not expect dramatic changes in terms of returning to, for instance, negotiations over a trade and investment partnership. Second aspect where I think we would not expect massive changes is in the sort of brewing and more than brewing confrontation between the United States and China. In fact, in some respects, particularly when it comes to human rights issues, we would probably expect that confrontation to deepen even further.
So that brings us to Minxin Pei. How will China respond to that?
Well, China will largely be on the defensive. On the whole, I think they are treating this election outcome with relief, but their expectations are relatively low. What they are going to do is to largely pursue a tit-for-tat strategy, trying to respond cooperatively if a Biden administration shows goodwill, but they are likely to stick to very hardline positions if they believe that there's really no big difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration.
Natalie Tocci, how much does Europe really believe that America can change under Joe Biden?
There has already been, I think, in the sort of last days, a debate sort of brewing in Europe about the fact that, you know, we cannot simply think that we can sort of flip back to where we were four years ago. And that indeed some of the changes that, in a sense, sort of Trump and Trumpism have represented are probably long lasting, which essentially means that as Europeans, what we probably have to do is assume greater risk and greater responsibility, and that ultimately that greater risk and responsibility taking and sharing with the United States is going to make up the stuff of a healthier transatlantic relationship with the Biden administration.
And Marwan Muasher, to you, how different does it look in the Middle East with the impending departure of President Trump?
I think you can expect changes in at least three main areas. On the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's clear that the Trump plan is out, and that's good news for the Palestinians, good news for Jordan. In the area of human rights and democracy, a lot of Arab countries are not going to feel they can pursue violations of human rights with impunity from the United States. So you can expect some Arab countries to be concerned about this. And the third area is Iran, where I would say you can also expect an attempt to restart negotiations with Iran and have a new agreement on the nuclear issue.
Natalie Tocci, that aligns, of course, with what Europe is hoping, to restart negotiations with Iran. But as you pointed out, not all of the U.S. policies will align with Europe. So how fundamentally different do you think the U.S.-European relationship will be under President Biden?
Well, I think it will be fundamentally different. I mean, I think, one shouldn't belittle just how hard the last 4 years have been. I mean, for the first time in the history of the European integration project, our closest ally and partner essentially looked at us as being pretty much an adversary, if not at times an outright enemy. So that will fundamentally change, and it will change in terms of attitudes towards European security, sort of seeing eye to eye on a number of issues in our neighborhood, and perhaps most importantly, approaching sort of global governance, multilateralism, partnerships on a global scale, basically as, Europeans and Americans playing on the same team.
Minchin Pei, Vice President Biden's team tells me that they are going to focus on domestic issues and focus on the realignment with Europe and then approach China, hopefully, in their words, together with their Western European allies. Do you believe that in that case, China would respond differently?
If the Biden administration is successful in getting its allies on board, then the U.S. will approach China from a position of real strength. But I also want to say that Biden's China policy will not be fundamentally different from the Trump administration's China policy. What we are going to see the difference is mainly in terms of tone. It will adopt a much less strident tone. It will also adopt much more subtle, sophisticated tactics, and it will be much more selective in terms of where to confront China.
To the Middle East, again, Marwan Muasher, you described the differences that you expect in a Biden administration policy. How will the region respond? And go a little bit more in depth, given that one of Biden's particular priorities is not only scrapping the peace deal, as you suggested, but really trying to get back into the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal is a major concern for Gulf countries who felt that President Obama signed a deal with the Iranians at the expense of Iranian interference in the region. So they would like to see any new deal include elements that would check Iranian influence in the region. But as I said, the Palestinians are going to be relieved, not because they expect President Biden to initiate anything serious on the Arab-Israeli conflict, but because they can at least expect to stop the deterioration that the Trump plan and the policies of President Trump has done to the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Minchin Pei, the question of American democracy is one that's been on the lips of many U.S. officials here when it comes to China, trying to make this an ideological battle between the Communist Party of China and the West. And frankly, Xi Jinping has also made this an ideological battle. Do you think that would continue under a Biden administration?
Oh, absolutely. I think the values issue will be an issue the Biden administration has enormous strengths upon. On the other hand, I think the President Trump's refusal to concede plays into China's hand in its own narrative, which is that U.S. democracy is declining, there is enormous decay in the system, and the U.S. should get its own house in order before trying to confront China.
And finally, Marwan Muasher, I wonder about that idea of U.S. democracy declining from the Middle East. Does the U.S. have the influence that it used to in the Middle East?
Let's remember that President Biden would probably devote most of his time, at least in the early stages of his administration, to domestic issues and to repairing the domestic rift in the United States. I think his administration is going to have little bandwidth to deal with an issue like the Arab-Israeli conflict, for example, in the Middle East, and would prefer to devote their energies to Europe and China more than to our region.
Marwan Muasher, Natalie Tocci, Minchin Pei, thank you very much to all of you.
Wildfires have scorched much of the American West this year. Joksana Corona and her family in Talent, Oregon, were among the residents forced to flee. Our Brief But Spectacular team reached them at the Girl Scout facility where they've been living.
The morning of September 8th, I didn't sleep very well because it was very windy. I got a text from an emergency alert system saying that there was a fire in Ashland and to take precautions. It looked way too close. And then that's when my neighbor said, oh, no, the fire department's gonna take care of it. And then I said, no, this wind is gonna screw us over. So I ran inside, I called my husband, took him 20 minutes to get home to us. He ran inside and got our kids' birth certificates, our passports, and he said, we gotta go. We evacuated our house by 12:05 p.m. We had lived in our home for 17 years. Me and my husband, next month we'll be married 17 years. So we pretty much bought that house 5 months before we got married. So that's the only home I've ever known. I was born in Mexico and my family moved to LA in 1989. My legal status is that I have DACA. Out of our mobile home park, which had 100 homes, 90 burned. I felt like there was no information really going on by authorities. I felt that most of the information I was getting was from other people's Facebook posts. I can't imagine what it was like for my neighbors who stayed waiting for that warning to come. That warning never came. My daughter, every friend she has lost their home. My son only knows three friends who didn't lose their home. The next day, one of my husband's cousins sent me a text and a picture. The picture pretty much showed where my house would have been. There was nothing recognizable. Everything was just ashes. I'm still a little scared. I'm still wondering how long it's gonna be before I can feel safe. We're staying at a local Girl Scout facility where we were offered shelter. And it's hard because our housing market here in Southern Oregon was already really low. I don't want to move anywhere else. My kids have been in the same school district since they were little. I was PTA president of our elementary school. I did a lot of advocacy work for undocumented families. That is home. Helping is not what I do, it's who I am. I was known in my community as someone that people can reach out to if they needed questions or resources for undocumented families. And I feel like my community has supported me 100% because of the work that I give back. When we lost everything, people reached out to me. And I never thought that people who I had helped in the past would be the ones who would be helping me today. I have had so much support from people. My name is Joksana Corona, and this is my brief but spectacular take on surviving a wildfire.
What a story of courage, and we certainly hope all that help continues. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.